At the moment, I'm not looking through diesel fog, but through the mists of time to 35 years ago and the Hope Royal Commission on Australia's Security and Intelligence Agencies. It was taking place in Canberra. And David Coombe, who I knew pretty well when he was the Federal Secretary of the Australian Labor Party, who'd sort of morphed into a lobbyist and was a well-known Russophile, was in a bit of trouble. And it wasn't just his friendship with Russian diplomat and KGB agent Valery Ivanov that was causing him difficulties and would, in fact, go on to embarrass the Hawke government. It was also his relationship with businessman Laurie Matheson. Laurie had employed David to lobby on behalf of his export business and the main destination for his goods, Russia. But who was Laurie Matheson and how close was his relationship with ASIO? And why did he roll over on David Coombe? Murky matters. Thornton McCamish is a freelance journo and author who's been digging into the life of Laurie for an article in the latest edition of The Monthly, which I thought was great fun. He was last on the program a couple of years ago talking about his biography of Alan Moorhead. Welcome back, Thornton.
Thanks very much, Philip.
Give me a brief CV of Laurie Matheson. He had a rough start in life, didn't he?
Rags to riches all the way. So he was brought up pretty hard in Western Sydney, I think. His own parents put him in an orphanage at the age of 12. He stayed there for several years before he joined the Navy as a rating at the age of 17. Changed his name. He'd previously been Lawrence Phelan and took his mother's name to become Matheson. Stayed in the Navy for 20 years and slowly worked his way.
He had a pretty good record in both Vietnam and Korea.
Well, it depends who you talk to, as is so often the case with Laurie Matheson. His naval record doesn't contain any traces of serving in Korea. He had a couple of weeks on the Melbourne, the aircraft carrier in Vietnam. But other sources suggest that he probably had a much more lively military career than his record suggests.
See, I'm just working from the ASIO file and you can't trust ASIO.
Oh, you've got it.
You can't trust ASIO.
You're not supposed to tell anyone you've seen it.
You would have to wonder if he'd been identified early as a possible Russian spy because, they sent him to language school.
Yeah, very early. So in 1954, he went to the Point Cook Languages School down here in Victoria and became very proficient in Russian and kept it up and sort of polished it over the years and spent at least 1 year working in naval intelligence.
And, of course, having no close family would make him a better ASIO recruit.
Well, I suppose that's true. The trouble is we don't really have access to the sort of vital records that would tell us just how closely involved he was with ASIO. It's a story that slowly formed through supposition and sort of triangulating various suggestive facts. But certainly by the end of the Hope Royal Commission, I don't think anyone was under any illusions that he was certainly an informant for ASIO. I mean, spy is a pretty big word, I guess.
Well, let me get the sequence right. He leaves the Navy, joins the Foreign Service. How did that work for him?
Well, it worked very well. So in 1968, he left the Navy. He was an officer by then. But it seems that Jack McEwen personally encouraged him to join
the Navy. We should remind younger listeners that Jack McEwen was the deputy PM and head of what was then the Country Party.
The Country Party, that's right. And with the best interests of Australia's farmers at heart, he was trying to restart trade with Russia, which had fallen to very low levels. I think it was something like $40 million total between the two countries in the late 60s. So Laurie was sent to Vienna, which was as close as we could get to Moscow then and the Trade Commission Service. He was he travelled to Moscow frequently with the head man in Vienna. And then in 72, we moved to Moscow itself to work for Heine Brothers, who were trying to get some trade going in Moscow. It wasn't until Laurie set up on his own in late 75 that things really turned around. And by the end of the decade, only 3 or 4 years later, bilateral trade was nearly $1 billion, depending on how you measure it. I mean, it had really gone through the roof. And Laurie was making an awful lot of money.
Well, you talk, there was one deal, for example, frozen mutton, involving $140 million, of which around $4 million would have been Laurie's commission.
Well, that's right, yes.
That used to be a lot of money.
That was when $4 million meant something. Some terrific journalists began to do work on this back in the Ivanov Affair days. George Munster in particular had a very shrewd eye for a company return, and he managed to work out that Laurie didn't seem to be paying very much tax at all and claimed very poor profit-loss records for someone who was making such large amounts. So Laurie's sort of trouble with the authorities began then, probably. But to be fair, there's no doubt he was, for however reason, he was achieving extraordinary results in Russia. He seemed to be a genuine Russophile, someone who really enjoyed living and working there, unlike a lot of, you know, overseas people in those days when it really was a tough place to work, when you knew that you were going to be followed around. A lot of people felt like they were being monitored all the time. Laurie himself knew that his staff in Moscow were being interrogated or questioned regularly. It wasn't an easy place to set up an operation or be a diplomat or anything, but he seemed to thrive there.
I remember Moscow at that time, and you know, you'd go and you'd walk into your hotel room by the Red Square, and you could see the bloody microphones dangling off the chandeliers. I mean, it was absolutely outrageously open, and you were followed, and it was all rather exciting, but it must have made life tense for Laurie, even though he was making a big quid or lots of rubles.
Oh, I think so. And I think the stress got to him. I mean, I managed to speak to several people who knew him during those halcyon days in Moscow. And while they said that he could be terrific fun and was somebody who could really show you how to enjoy Moscow, and a lot of people really struggled to enjoy it for the reasons you've outlined, he could also get worn down by the stress of it all, and didn't have a very good relationship at all with our ambassadors in Moscow. He sort of mocked the embassy, really. I think he felt that he was doing the real serious work that was achieving results for
you. You mentioned that increase in business from 42 million in 69 to a billion in 79. That is immense. And he was a big player in that increase?
Yes, he was. So the real key to his financial success was that he managed to get his company, Commercial Bureau Australia, accredited. It was the sole Australian company accredited to trade between Russia and Australia. So all kinds of goods, whether it was acrobats or butter, cheese, you name it, had to flow through his company one way or another. And he also ran the freight for a lot of this stuff. And there was a lot of profit to be made out of organising the shipping.
He was vertically integrated.
He certainly was, yes.
I'm talking to Thornton McCamish, author and journalist, about Laurie Matheson, our man in Moscow. So was he reporting to ASIO during this period?
It appears that he was... debriefing to ASIO handlers in that period. And then he was certainly doing it in the early 80s, in 81 and 82, when things heated up back home with Ivanov and Coombe, yes.
I think I should ask you this. Was he a particularly charismatic person? Was he?
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing that got me interested in him in the first place. I just happened to be talking to someone who'd known him and was telling some fairly extraordinary stories, if slightly implausible ones. And I thought it might be worth having a look at this. So I did some research. And the more people I spoke to, the more I realised that most of the people who'd known him well remembered him as an unusually charismatic, likable, generous, and quite remarkable fellow one way or another. He was hugely intellectually curious. He was an autodidact. He was genuinely interested in art and artists, and very generously supported several young artists to get started in their careers.
Well, I understand that he helped someone who I regard as a protege of mine as well, and Peter Schipperheim, for example, the sculptor.
Ah, yes. Well, very much. Very much. I spoke to Peter and he remembers Laurie very, very affectionately and says he sort of had a huge impact on his life. So for someone who's gone down in national history as, you know, an overnight millionaire who dobbed in a mate to ASIO, this was somebody who really left a very strong impression on the people who were close to him. Not everyone. He had his detractors. But he was clearly an unusual person, and everybody has a story, their own story to tell about him.
Well, you know, when I sort of see him through your eyes, he's a bit of a Gatsby.
Yeah. Well, when he came to live in Mount Macedon, just out of Melbourne, in the very early 80s, his business was, we now know, already in all sorts of trouble. But that wasn't the impression he gave. He arrived clearly very wealthy. There was something a little bit mysterious about him. He was warm, but he was hard to get to know. But he was very much worth getting to know if you could, because he was the sort of fellow who would thrust gifts on his near and dear and do his best for you.
Did he throw the odd party?
He certainly did. Macedon? He did throw the odd party, and people still remember hearing about the Russians, you know, singing songs and smashing glasses up at Denira, which is the magnificent homestead he purchased there. So he was somebody that people talked about. And he didn't seem to mind people talking about him, because the other really interesting thing about Matheson is that he was someone who seemed to have this predilection for misdirection about himself and for perhaps making things up, frankly.
Well, that's Gatsby-like again, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. And you even get that sense of, you know, some sort of hidden sort of compulsion going on. Now, whether that was just a great desire to make money or whether it was a great desire to hide his tracks in some way.
Did he have a personal life?
Well, I'm sure he did. I tried to avoid going into that in this piece. I didn't want to invade the privacy of people still living and his family and so on.
Okay.
But
he did want to be accepted, didn't he, into society. And so he becomes a patron of the arts, as we've mentioned.
Yes, that's right. So some people remember him as this sort of loner, you know, this driven and fascinating, charismatic kind of loner. And they tend to be men, I think it's probably worth pointing out. Younger men who perhaps had office jobs and looked up to him as someone who'd had all this daring do in his background and could easily be sort of imagined into a James Bond-like shape.
Well, we're running out of time, so let's push it along. Right. He comes into contact with David Coombe, who I knew reasonably well when, in his era as the national, you know, director of the party. He was looking for someone to help him gain access to power to get some of the bigger projects up and running. So David was the go-to man.
Yes, well, he was one of the go-to men. Matheson had this habit of employing a lobbyist at the drop of a hat. He had several going at any one time. But yes, certainly he employed David Coombe to help him with a particular project, which was a joint fishing project. He wanted to get started with a Soviet state fishing agency. And the problem Matheson was having was that a former employee had broken away from the company and set up a rival organization, which was also trying to get permission for this really enormous project. And so Matheson employed Coombe to try to help him persuade the political authorities, particularly in New South Wales, to favour his company. But in the short term, he asked Coombe to go to Moscow, where he was already going, to talk to the people there about his companies and how his company was standing with important contacts in the hierarchy there.
And of course, David was involved with KGB agent Ivanov.
Yeah. It was just a very unfortunate series of events, I think, for Coombe when you look back on it. He'd come to know Coombe through the Friendship Society, I think it was called, the USSR Australia Friendship Society. David had been to Russia at least a couple of times, I think, before that, and was a genuine Russophile, as you said. And he had come to know Ivanov reasonably well. And it was when he was taped bragging to Ivanov after several drinks one night that people came to think that perhaps he was rather too enthusiastic about setting up trade relations for someone whose loyalty should have been very much with the government.
Thornton, he gave evidence against Coombe, didn't he? Was, you know, why?
Why, yeah. So Matheson told, well, Coombe, according to Matheson's version, is that Coombe told him that Ivanov had said, listen, I think my phone's being bugged, we better, you know, have these meetings, Coombe and Ivanov, more clandestinely in future. And Matheson apparently told that to ASIO. Now, Coombe denied that that sort of form of words had ever been used. But I don't think anyone seriously doubts that that's what Matheson did. Now, why did he? It's hard to say. I mean, this is where you really have to make up your own mind about the sort of man he was. My suspicion is that as an ex-serviceman, he was a bit of an old-fashioned figure about, you know, driven by issues of sort of honour and loyalty more than anything. And I think his first loyalty was perhaps to the country. I think that's probably where I come down. Now, it's obviously not much of a mate's act to dob someone in, especially someone that you'd employed. But I wonder whether he felt that he was impelled to say what he knew.
Well, whatever happened, the Royal Commission was the end of both their careers, wasn't it? Because David lost his status as a lobbyist and became an embarrassment to his old friend Hawke.
Yeah,
Laurie sold his business to IXL.
Yes, that's right. Well, he'd had IXL, which was then being run by John Elliott, of course, involved in this pitch for the fishing
program. I've always thought that John Elliott was a KGB agent.
That could be my next piece. So he did that. He stayed on as a consultant. I mean, to Coombe's credit, we should say he did recover and he ended up having a good career as a wine industry consultant, I think. But yes, for the next few years, I think the next few years were very tough for him. But Matheson didn't last much longer after that. He died in 1987.
You visited his grave at Mount Macedon and found it rather unusual.
Well, yes, early on when I'd heard some of these stories, I found myself up there having a look around. It's Schipperhein actually sculpted this rather beautiful sort of naked, sorrowing female figure sort of draped on the grave. And it's a very, you know, if you walk into the cemetery, you can't be drawn to it because it's such an unusual thing to see. The other unusual thing about it is that there's another grave for Laurie Matheson right next to it. I think that struck me that, you know, for a man who was very secretive about his background and his business dealings and exactly what he'd done for 20 years in the Navy, this was a very eye-catching sort of public memorial.
One final sort of question. There's some who doubt his untimely death in 87. Do you?
I don't, but it was striking. I mean, a couple of people I managed to get in touch with who seemed to be very sort of sober-minded in other respects assured me that there was no way he died when people said he had, which I don't mention that in any way to suggest that that could be true, but just to show just how strong an impression Matheson's mysteriousness could sort of make on people who perhaps like to imagine that the world is more interesting than it seems to be on the surface.
Well, I'm grateful to you because although I thought I remembered the circumstances of the whole Coombe-Ivanov affair, I'd all but forgotten Laurie Matheson, and you've brought him back to life and indeed to his to death. In our little chat. So thank you very much for that, Thornton.
Oh, pleasure to talk to you.
Thornton McCamish is an author and freelance journalist, and his article on Laurie is in this month's edition of The Monthly, which is, I think, a commendable journal.